good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. Nature Radio of the people, by the people, for the people, at least on Thursdays at 11 o'clock with this program, Green Zine, hosted by Henry Swayze and myself, Todd Tyson. Just want to make sure that we acknowledge our underwriters here that have kept us going for more than 12 years with this show and with this community radio station, staffed by all volunteers. And they include the White River. No, they don't include them anymore. Solar Fest, the First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Leibowitz, Royal Trailworks, Bale, and Soliflect. More about Solar Fest later in the show if I think of it. And I will throw in a White River partnership are now underwriters. Thank you very much, Mary and Greg Russ. Our good buddy Dan Rudell works with them as well. So, yeah, for you solar folks who like to get a little sun, not too much sun, and maybe you're getting your energy from the sun, either your personal walking around energy or what energizes your house or your vehicle, I thought I would play this one from Paul Winter. It's called Sun Singer. Let's go back to Sun Singer for a bit, and then we'll join Henry, and we're going to dip a little bit deeper into What If We Get It Right? Well, Henry, I know you weren't feeling anxious, but if you were, this would have calmed you down.
It's always good to have something calming.
I was just reading.
In this day and age, that's required for every day,
yeah.
A bit calming.
A lot of people stressed out by the daily news or doing doom scrolling, et cetera, or looking around and wondering whether the Constitution is going to hang in there or not. If there's time a little bit later in the show, we might touch on the philosophy of forest bathing, which we've done before, but there's a little something I think that Margaret Osha in the Herald wrote about. So what's happening in your world, Henry?
Well, I'm up in Burlington as usual, and I on Tuesday, I attended, which was hot up here, I attended a conference at Shelburne Farm, and we'll visit a little bit about that after Bird Note, some interesting things, mostly pertaining to some kind of historical things that are interesting, and then news about Shelburne Farm and news about how to make clay soils do better for you if you're trying to grow things, and when you do make those soils grow things better, it's also good for the environment. So you get a twofer on that one. Anyway, so we'll do that after Bird Note, and our dipping back into the What If We Get It Right. We're going to start off with okay, what's the state of affairs and what's really happening right now? And it's 4 minutes of pretty negative content, and then we'll get into some, okay, so what's to do now? How do you what's the antidote for that besides Paul Winter's?
Yeah, and actually, I do have a copy of the book. When we played that excerpt last week from Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson's book, What If We Get It Right? I pulled this off the bookshelf, and I think towards the end, after we go through those two recorded segments, we'll go to page 422, where Ayanna has partnered with a woman named Oana Staniscu to devise a climate oath, sort of roughly based on the Hippocratic Oath that people in the medical profession take. So looking forward to that. We also have the latest commentary. We won't go all into it, from Bill McKibben. My partner gets his newsletter, and I just signed up for it to catch up on things. So we'll get to that as well. But I am looking at these beautiful birds. Can you find rufous hummingbirds in Vermont, Henry?
Yes, I think maybe they're not unlike other hummingbirds, but I'm pretty sure they're the ones that come to Vermont. There's about 18 varieties of hummingbirds, and Vermont only gets one.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yes.
Because these guys don't look like the ones that have been coming to our feeder. Yeah.
All right. Well, then they are from elsewhere, but I think the raising of young is very similar. So
okay, let's go to this
stand one. In for our situation.
And what it says here, and this is going to be Bird Note. We're going to play it for you. Rufous hummingbirds in summer, mighty big chicks in a tiny nest. You're listening to Green Zine on Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. For many folks in the Pacific Northwest, Western Canada, and Alaska, the return of the rufous hummingbird in the spring is cause for celebration. The deep buzz of their arrival marks the start of summer. In July, many of the fiery red adult males have begun their migration southward. Meanwhile, the female rufous hummingbird has fledged her first two nestlings and is just about to fledge a second brood. The chicks are now as big as their mother, making the walls of their walnut-sized nest bulge outwards at maximum capacity. It takes about 40 days to fledge each brood, from egg-laying until the young learn to fly. They learn to feed on their own through trial and error until they finally figure out which flowers offer the best nectar. Nearly all the rufous hummingbirds will begin their migration by late August, sipping their way south on high mountain wildflowers all the way to Mexico, until they whistle into our lives again in spring. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. If you ever miss a Bird Note, you can always get the latest episode. Just tell your smart speaker, play the podcast Bird Note. Learn more on our website, birdnote.org.
Yeah, I haven't gotten one of those smart speakers yet. We have some dumb speakers here in the studio, but no smart speakers. I meant the equipment, not the people.
Those people behind the microphone. So I stand corrected. I have done a little research while we were listening to that. And ruby-throated hummingbirds, most frequently spotted in Vermont.
Yes.
During the breeding season, April to October. There are also rufous hummingbirds also seen in Vermont. And Mexican violier, I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, rarely visits Vermont, but does exist here. And I think all hummingbirds that I've seen have been the ruby-throated hummingbirds. And in that Bird Note, in the text that went with it, they said that when the females are starting to take care of raising their second clutch of eggs, the males hightail it south. They stop working and say, okay, this female's all tied up with young. I'm not going to hang around, which I had never aware of. Birds so frequently are the male and the female stick with the whole process all the way through.
Yeah, interesting. Well, in that intro there in Bird Note, it did mention the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada, but I guess some of those rufous guys can make it all the way over to Vermont occasionally?
Yeah, I think it's the there's a rufous hummingbird and a ruby-throated hummingbird.
Yeah, the ruby-throated one.
The ruby-throated one is the one I think it's the only one I've ever seen.
Yeah, most common. Yeah, they're wonderful. Yeah. I love the sound, which I think both species have that same buzzing sound. I think that's kind of maybe something to calm your nerves too when you hear that gentle buzzing of a hummingbird.
They're pretty jazzy birds. They're very, very busy. Their heart rate's way up there, and their wing beats are way up there, and they can actually fly backwards and forward, which they do when they're sipping nectar.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any other bird that can do that.
And another thing, as far as their aerodynamic skills, that as mating season comes in, the male that does that big looping, high loop up and then diving back down to impress the female, and we see that right off our porch. It's great watching that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. I haven't seen that there. I see hummingbirds chasing other hummingbirds away from the feeder because they think they're quite territorial about a feeding spot.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, yeah. No. My partner pointed that out a few years ago. That oh, there he's doing his mating, climbing and diving, and once again out there doing it again this year. Well, we're about 12 minutes into the show. Henry, what do you think? We could go into a small piece, or we could go into the first part excerpt from the book, What If We Get It Right?
Well, let me just take three or four minutes, and I'll describe the Shelburne Farm piece.
Oh, that'd be good to hear.
So I went there, Dale Strickler, who is from the West and has farmed in many places, but on clay soils, was doing a workshop on how you get clay soils to work better. And one of the secrets to that is warm season grasses. And we think of ourselves not having any warm season grasses. But he said that in the when the Europeans first got to America, the only open ground that wasn't wooded were the river valleys, and that the settlers, when they wanted to plant crops, tilled that all up, and there were warm season grasses predominating all of those river bottoms, and that the tillage stopped them from continuing because the warm season grasses, in order to grow the next year or to thrive, have got to have mycorrhizal fungi, and that's the kind of fungi that wraps around the root and is an extension of the root of the plant, and it can't stand tillage. So when you have tilled up a field, you've killed off that particular kind of fungi, and the warm season grasses. Now we see them in those tall grasses that people plant in wet spots for just attractive displays. And, you know, and once you get it established, it hangs in there, but it doesn't stand tillage. And it is for clay soils, it helps bring oxygen down into the clay and allows microbes to start growing and roots to grow. And it's a way of getting much deeper topsoil than you would have had before. So that's just interesting. I thought the history of the fact that it was here and now no one thinks that they survive here because we plowed them all out. was interesting.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether, you know, flooding is very much in the news, not only in Vermont, but obviously the devastating floods out in off the Guadalupe River and other waterways in Texas. If those grasses that existed before settlers came and started tilling up, which made sense as far as, hey, there's the open ground, it's right next to a river, let's do some planting there. If any of those grasslands, riverside grasslands, had survived, whether that would have been excellent erosion control, I would think it would be.
Yes. Well, the other thing is that when you build topsoil, the topsoil becomes a sponge.
Mm.
And so not so much, wherever that topsoil is a sponge, it absorbs a rainfall instead of letting it run off. And if you have well-developed topsoil, it can survive things like 3 inches of rainfall that just fell in the Northeast Kingdom and caused all kinds of road washout and a few building washouts up there just in the last week or so.
Yeah.
And so having improving the quality of the soil has a real effect on preventing flooding, and it also prevents runoff, so you aren't carrying all that silt and the biggest contributor to blue-green algae in Lake Champlain is phosphorus. And it's phosphorus coming off of the soil that make up back roads getting washed into the riverways and then into Lake Champlain.
Yep.
And that's I mean, people's lawns and commercial agriculture both contribute to it. But it's the back road dirt getting washed downstream. And for the east side of the state, all that water is going into the Connecticut, and they don't have the algae problem. They have problems with nitrogen, but not with algae. But the Champlain Valley and Lake Champlain has a serious problem with having to reduce the phosphorus content that's going in the lake.
Yeah, I know. Just to go back to salt and runoff here from our dirt roads, that some towns are starting to look at maybe lessening or getting rid of putting chloride in, their dust dampening efforts. When that sodium chloride gets on the road and then it gets washed into the nearby brook and ends up in the Connecticut River, then we're back to what you were just talking about, chemicals getting into the water system and not really helping nature very much.
So I can remember Tunbridge before they put chloride on the roads, and in midsummer when a car went by our house, it left a cloud of fine particles, with really clay content from the road material in the air, and it was beyond your car, and if you were traveling behind someone like that, you'd
be breathing it in
three or 400 yards behind them rather than hugging their bumper because you didn't want to eat their dust. So the chloride has a practical advantage, which is why the towns have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And when that clay dust gets blown out of the road surface, then you're left with a much sandier material that washes more. So it's tricky to do the balance with what's it doing to the environment and how well is it making roads and what are the other alternatives. I don't have the answers to those, but I remember when they started putting salt on summer roads rather than leaving it just for the blacktop in the winter.
Right, right. Huh. All right. Well, that's probably something. Well, maybe we'll get a roadmaster from one of the towns to discuss the history of treating the roads. We're up to 20 after. Should we go to section one?
Let's listen to this. So here, let's listen to the "What if we get it right?" So this is in the early part of the book, one of the first couple of chapters, and there's two sections, just kind of an honest. Here's where we're at, and So we'll listen to that one first.
Yeah, and we'll come back with you. Just to remind you, I'm going to bring Henry down in the mix. You are listening to Green Zine, your weekly environmental news magazine here at Royalton Community Radio.
Section 4. Follow the money. It's funny how money changes situation. Lauren Hill. What if we reimagine capitalism regeneratively? What if your tax dollars drive decarbonization? What if companies lobby for climate policy? What if the wealthy go all in on climate solutions? What if banks stop financing fossil fuels? What if climate benefit is the test for every dollar spent? What if corporations consider Earth as a shareholder? What if? 10 problems. Climate change could cause $38 trillion in global economic damages every year by 2050. The climate impacts of burning fossil fuels cause around $500 billion in losses every year, from property damage to government spending on recovery, construction surge inflation, and power outages. The gap in GDP per capita between the richest and poorest countries is 25% larger than it would be without climate change. The richest 10% of the world population owns 76% of the wealth, takes 52% of the income, and accounts for 48% of global carbon emissions. The poorest 50% of the world gets only 8.5% of the income and accounts for 12% of carbon emissions. Since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, 60 banks have provided $6.9 trillion in financing to fossil fuel companies, with the top four U.S. banks alone, JPMorgan Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, providing more than $1.46 trillion. To reach the Paris Agreement goals, financing for climate solutions must increase by at least 590%. To $4.35 trillion annually by 2030. Pension funds, which hold more than $46 trillion in assets worldwide, are among the largest institutional investors in fossil fuels. Just 14 public pension funds in the U.S. have a combined $81.6 billion invested in fossil fuels. Globally, only 1.6% of philanthropy funding goes to climate. In the U.S., only 0.5%. Approximately 70% of U.S. foundation and nonprofit leaders state that they have no plans to divest from fossil fuels. Nearly 50% of corporations do not have a net zero pledge, and 58% of global business executives agree that their companies have overstated their sustainability commitments. Trade associations for fossil fuel-related companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year to obstruct climate policy via advertisements, lobbying, and political donations. 10 possibilities. Every $1 invested in resilient infrastructure can yield $4 in benefits. Getting to net zero is a more than $12 trillion business opportunity. In 2023, $1.8 trillion was invested in the clean energy transition, a new record. Due to the favorable economics of renewables, decarbonizing the energy system by 2050 could save up to $15 trillion. In 2023, for the second year in a row, banks generated more revenue from environmentally friendly investing, about $3 billion, than from fossil fuel investing, $2.7 billion. Also in 2023, renewable energy sources accounted for 22% of electricity generation in the U.S., surpassing both nuclear and coal. And globally, for new energy production capacity added in 2023, 86% was from renewables, mostly solar. Globally, the clean energy sector employed 36.2 million people in 2023, up 6 million from 2019. In the U.S., over 3.3 million people were employed in the clean energy sector as of 2022, over three times more than in fossil fuels. Reforming fossil fuel subsidies and putting a price on carbon could generate $2.8 trillion globally in government revenues in 2030. More than 1,600 institutions have divested more than $40 trillion from fossil fuel stocks. Foundation funding for mitigating climate change has quadrupled from $900 million in 2015 to more than $3.7 billion in 2022. In 2023, more than 23,000 companies, collectively worth at least $67 trillion, disclosed their environmental data on greenhouse gas emissions, deforestation, and/or water use, a 300% increase since the Paris Agreement.
Okay, Henry, I think that ends the first segment.
Yeah, I was thinking there was even a little bit more in that one, but I guess not. I must have decided it was just too grim. So there's some positive information in there, and I think that this, you know, we played pieces from last week with Bill McKibben out of the same book, and you know he's 350.org, and then the Third Act effort that he's making now, all about the 350.org is all about divesting from fossil fuel infrastructure. And the Third Act is let's get involved with people who are in their retirement years with making things happen. But I think that the scary thing is that, you know, when if we have a 501k or we work for a corporation that has some kind of a retirement fund, or if you're looking at unions and the like, and where they're stashing their money, the state of Vermont for years was invested in coal mines, and I believe that they no longer will invest money. But the bottom line is that the chief financial honchos are saying, well, we have to invest in the thing that makes the most money. It doesn't make any difference whether it causes damage or not, whether it's unfair, whether it's unethical. We just have to invest where we make the most money.
Right.
Because that's our fiduciary responsibility. And I think that that's one of the things that that many of us can do is to ask that question about how are monies that are going to be useful to us, how are they invested, and can we defossilize that for a Henry term.
Yeah. Hey, well, but I'm gonna jump ahead while we're just on this subject, Henry. You are often in attendance at town meeting in Tunbridge, and of course we've got town meetings all throughout the state of Vermont. Tunbridge is a town that has it live. It's not Australian rules. And a report is given by the trustees of public funds. And I remember a few years ago, there were some questions about you know, who is managing that money and where it's going? It seems like that would be a reasonable question from the floor, if not before. I know the Tunbridge actually is, their trustees of public funds are getting together tomorrow morning to question whether that sort of prerogative could be added to the analysis, because I know that at large investment companies or you know, trust companies, their number one thing is they need to maintain that asset and increase that asset. And so if you said, well, I happen to have a bunch of money that, not me personally, but you're someone talking to their trust officer, that I don't like where it is right now. Even though it's gaining 8% a year, I want you to get out of the gun manufacturer or out of, you know, the XL pipeline business. They can't really do that right away. They can slowly change things over, but maybe with a little grassroots pressure, we could change that.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that's well worth doing. And the reality is, if you look at a comparative stock portfolio with and without fossil fuels over the last 5 or 6 years, the stock market portfolio without the fossil fuels in it does every bit as well as the other one. Now, the fact that that Trump has blocked any support for wind and solar, and has done everything he possibly can for the fossil fuel end of things, may have some short-term ramifications for portfolios.
Yeah.
But it's certainly a deal with the devil to be continuing with that. Should we go on to the next section? So this next clip is okay. So what's to do about this situation? And in particular, it is encouraging people to figure out what their skills are and how they can be useful and be part of the solution instead of just standing on the sidelines and feeling as though there's nothing they can do.
Okay, yeah, let's go. And once again, to remind folks, they're listening to Green Zine, and we are playing some excerpts from an audio book version of an excellent book written by an environmentalist, a scholar. She currently is teaching, I can't remember whether it's at the University of Maine or maybe at one of the, either Bates College or Bowdoin. Her name is Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. The name of the book that you'll be hearing from is What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures.
Or if you find yourself grasping for a futurism that doesn't feel naive, ditto, we'll muddle through together. I don't have all the answers, not by a mile, but I have listened to a lot of smart people, seen art and poetry that show the way, and I'm putting the puzzle pieces together. If ever there were a moment for collective wisdom, this is it. All hands and minds and hearts on deck. So the core of this book is 20 interviews with people I have learned so much from, whose perspectives have deeply influenced mine. Footnote, quote, in conversation, we can hold thoughts and reflect on problems sometimes for hours on end. Human thought is inherently dialogic, end quote. David Graeber and David Wengrow. From the dawn of everything. I asked each of these folks similar questions about their visions for the future, barriers to achieving it, what we need to do next, and what they wish we knew. This way, we can aggregate their insights across the spectrum of expertise and solutions we must harness. This way, we can see a holistic answer to the title question. Exploring our climate challenges through deep conversations, unpacking and grappling together, is also what I hope you will do out in the world. Because for something so fundamental, we really don't talk about climate change much. While some of us spend a lot of time reading, worrying, doom scrolling, and posting about the climate crisis, seldom do we gather to discuss what we might do. Polling data makes this clear. Footnote, Yale and George Mason universities have been conducting rigorous polling on Americans' climate perspectives since 2012. See climatecommunication.yale.edu. In the U.S., despite 70% of Americans being concerned that climate change will harm plants, animals, and future generations, and 43% saying it has already affected them personally, a whopping 65% rarely or never talk about the topic with their friends and families. Furthermore, 11% of Americans, 37 million people, are willing to become actively engaged, but have not taken any actions yet. How's that for potential? Too often, the climate movement and the media tell everyone to do the same things. Vote, protest, donate, spread the word, and lower your carbon footprint. Footnote, the useful term carbon footprint, by the way, was popularized by fossil fuel companies in an attempt to put the weight of the blame on us as individuals. Get out of here with that nonsense. And yes, it's great to do those things, but all too rarely are we asked to contribute our specific talents, our superpowers. Here's one way to think about what you, specifically you, can do. It's a climate action Venn diagram with three overlapping circles. Footnote, if you're familiar with the Japanese concept of ikigai for finding your purpose, you can consider this a simplified, climate-focused version of that. For more, see climatevenn.info. Number one, what are you good at? What are your areas of expertise? What can you bring to the table? Think about your skills, resources, and networks. You have a lot to offer. Number two, what work needs doing? Are there particular climate and justice solutions you want to focus on? Think about systemic changes and efforts that can be replicated or scaled. There are heaps of options. Footnote, for a list of solutions, see drawdown.org/solutions. Number three, what brings you joy? Or perhaps a better word is satisfaction. What gets you out of bed in the morning? Choose climate actions that energize and enliven you. Where the circles overlap is where you'll find your climate action. If you'd like to better visualize what I'm talking about, take a look at the Venn diagram in the bonus PDF. For me, a marine biologist, policy nerd, and Brooklyn native worried about sea level rise and climate injustice, my own search for this Venn sweet spot led me to co-found Urban Ocean Lab, a policy think tank for the future of coastal cities. It's also how I ended up co-creating the Blue New Deal plan when the Green New Deal all but left out the ocean. Footnote, that story is told in the Changing the Rules section. And it's how I ended up writing this for you. As you listen, perhaps keep this framework in mind and consider what might be at the heart of your own diagram. The people I interviewed in this book have all found their unique and important climate roles, which I hope will inspire you to seek or refine or double down on yours.
All right, that was the voice of Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson from her book, What If We Get It Right?
And so just to review, because it takes a while for it to soak into my head, that Venn diagram is three different circles. A Venn diagram is one that you have different evaluations in different circles, and then you look at where they interact, and that interaction is the place that is the most productive place to put your effort and intention. And I think that last piece, so if we'll do it from the top, so what are you good at and what can you bring to the table was the first piece of that diagram. And, you know, some people don't think they have anything to bring to the table or are good at, but are. And you have to kind of be honest with yourself and think about that a bit. And then what needs doing? And I think her point about I certainly do it. I get drawn into just donate money to fundraising and doing things that are taking action but are kind of churning rather than fixing the problem. And then what needs doing needs, you know, is matures as you think about it. And the last one, which I think is perhaps the very most important, and that is what would make you feel satisfied that you've done? What would you be happy about having done? Because if you don't have something that gives you some feeling of, oh, gee, this was a good day, I did this, then you're not going to do it tomorrow, even though you know you should. And so think about those circles and see if there's places that you can focus effort at.
So Henry, I'm going to give, and I'm going to sort of pair you with this, and you can disagree, but just,
sure.
So we're doing a radio show here. We've been doing it for more than 12 years. You and I have been active in environmentalism, you a lot longer than I have. You're just a couple years older than me. You might have even moved to the state of Vermont for environmental reasons way, way long ago, 60 years ago. So one thing that we're really into, well, first, I've been in radio a long time. I'm a fairly good communicator, whether it's on the radio or with groups of people. I'm really into the environment. So looking at a way to communicate, which we do with this radio show, that's what we're talking about now, this environmentally based radio show, able to take the communication skills about a subject that you and I both care a lot about, and most of all of our listeners and a lot of people who don't listen to the radio, about climate change, the future generations, sustainability, protecting the land, protecting the plants, the animals, and then taking action that you feel pretty good about. So whether that's taking care of your land properly in a more responsible way, whether it's changing your vehicle, maybe you're riding your bike more, taking mass transit, maybe cutting back on flights, etc., that those things might feel pretty good. Eating your own organic produce from the garden, those are things that really are not necessarily egocentric, but people can feel really good about. So I think that is just sort of a thumbnail sketch of connecting those three, that Venn diagram.
I think the difficult piece, I agree with you completely on what you said, but I think the difficult piece in that Venn diagram is what needs doing.
And there's so much.
and there's so much, but... And you've got to ask yourself, well, if you take better care of your property in an ecological way, is that going to fix the problems of the world? How does that rank? So you have to think about what needs doing in a way that is personal for you, but still is effective in terms of making the changes that need to be made. And that's a complicated and difficult thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's most important that it feels good to you. If it doesn't feel good to you,
you're not going to do it anymore.
Persist.
Exactly right.
So
I have one more thing from the book here, if we're going to move on to something else. Yeah, so as I said, we picked up a copy when we got to see the author, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, speak up in Blue Hill, Maine at a book festival that they were having there. And there we've delved into this book a little bit several months ago, but I'm going to go pretty late in the book. And this is where Ayanna got together with a woman named Oana Stanescu to come up with a climate oath. And here's what they she says, we offer this model for you to make your own and pass along. On the majesty of turquoise seas and fireflies and aspen trees, on the honor of our parents, our ancestors, and humans to come, on the wonders of laughter and sunshine, I make these devotions to climate solutions for my community and for our magnificent planet. First, move from I to we. We will expand our sense of interdependence. We will rein in our sense of individualism. We will ask, what should we do together? Survival is collective. Our fates are intertwined. Second, do no harm. We will restore and heal, not pollute and deplete. We will regenerate ecosystems and our own resolve. We will live lightly as part of the earth. Accountability, generosity, and sweetness. Third, less is more. We will expand our creativity and contract our consumerism. We will conserve and distinguish between needing and wanting. We will be gentle with our own imperfections and others. There is no such thing as enough. Basta. Finally, possibility exists. This is a world of our making. We can remake it, remix it, restore it, rebalance it. The path of least resistance is only one of many paths. I will be part of getting it right. We will be part of getting it right.
I like that. I think we should adopt that as the opening mantra for a Green Zine program each week.
Right. We could accompany it with some music, but certainly, you know, maybe this might be difficult, but maybe at some point in the future we could have Professor Johnson join us here on Green Zine. I do have a contact to her agent, so I might be sending that along to you, Henry.
That would be good.
Yeah.
So, so early in the clips that I'd pulled out, she said that, or it was said that that interactions are didactic. They are something where you're discussing ideas developed because you're talking to other people, and I think that somehow I would love to have our radio programming trigger interactivity. I don't know whether we have to actually physically have a get-together on a regular basis or how to do it, but anybody who has suggestions for a way to bring this down to a person-to-person interaction that people can feel as though they know who has spoken and honor their thoughts and so forth, so that you're building community. I feel that's a failure of what we do, that there isn't that that interaction.
How about this, Henry? I'm throwing this out here. You know, we try to be somewhat somewhat orderly, but also somewhat spontaneous. A future climate cafe, which we would give plenty of notice about locally here, supporting a local business. So the cafe part, it could be at one of the underwriters of the radio station, for instance, First Branch Coffee, maybe up at Brocklebank, a place that maybe on a weekend when more people would be available, put the word out a month ahead of time that maybe on a Saturday or a Sunday, you know, afternoon or morning, we're going to get together, you know, bring your concerns, bring your concepts, your ideas, your positivity. And maybe we could get that going by early fall.
I like it. We could take that mantra that we're going to run every week and have that have the kickoff of that, have that be the framework for it.
Yeah, that could be kind of like, if we did it on a Sunday, kind of like a little mini sermon before getting involved in.
Yeah. Okay, so some positive news that's happening locally.
Yeah.
We've mentioned it on previous, because it happened a month or two ago, but the town of Tunbridge has deployed more solar.
Yes, it has. It's up and running.
And Todd is Todd has been a leader in having that happen, but I'm bringing it up because it's a positive thing that can happen locally, and it only happened because people in the community thought it should happen and made it happen.
Yeah, and just to point out some of the other supporters, Rodney, who is the the roads manager, who has solar, lives right in the middle of Tunbridge, so. He has ridden when I had a grease van. I don't know if he's been in one of the EVs, but someone who typically you might not think has, got time or interest in paying attention to the environment clearly was. He was very open to walking on the land out of the town garage, pointing out where, maybe not siting it there because we're going to have a sand pit there in a year or two. That's too close to the edge of what might erode. He was very helpful. Obviously, there was a grant opportunity being offered through the initial solar, through a federal, I think that was through the ARPA funds, and then the follow-up one was through what's called a MERP grant from the state. We certainly had the cooperation there. Tunbridge was fortunate enough to have a professional part-time grants administrator. And then talking to the select board, who remained open-minded about this. Obviously, expense was a concern, but it was pretty much all paid for. So it took a lot of people kind of working together, getting the information, and certainly for the second phase of this solar array out at the town garage, Kurt Mayland and his students from the Vermont Law and Graduate School were key to filling out a lot of the paperwork and meeting deadlines, filling in not only federal but state paperwork. And they are involved again in the possibility of bringing maybe even a high-speed EV charger to downtown Tunbridge sometime in the next several months. So it does take a village to get there.
Yes, indeed. And so that's that was a check one. Next one on my checklist was EV charging and bringing, helping support the fair and all the activities down there, because there are in Vermont about 12% of vehicle sales are electric vehicles. And there is no fast charging anywhere convenient to Tunbridge. You've got to go to White River or Mount Pelier to if you're traveling from somewhere.
Well, there are a couple that are closer to here, but we won't go into the locations. At some point, maybe we can generate a local map of where the chargers are. The ones here at the law school have some issues. They're working on that currently. There are 3 out of a total of 12 that are operating properly. So that is being looked into. So I want to reference last week's 7 days. One just came out, an excellent article written by someone that I think we might want to get back on the air. Do you remember talking with Kevin McCallum, the environmental writer for the 7 days,
yeah.
Henry? Yeah. So he wrote, and we did reference this briefly last week. It's on page 15 of the July 9th through 16th issue. No charge, the Scott administration declined to provide key info for the state's electric vehicle lawsuit. He quotes the transportation head for the state of Vermont in here as to explaining why our attorney general was not urged to join getting the money back. Most of the states that were going to lose this money for high-speed EV charging build-out successfully got the money back based on a court ruling. Vermont basically did not participate in that. So that certainly didn't help the cause. So now jumping ahead for a little bit of humor, in this week's 7 days, there's a cartoon, Tim Newcomb, a regular cartoonist. You will find this on page 7, and it shows Governor Scott sitting with his laptop at a fold-up table, but he's pretty near a cliff, and there's someone who's got their charging hose hooked up, but they don't have anywhere to put it, and the verbiage here, Governor quietly derailing EV charging development, and he is, obviously, he didn't say this, but Tim Newcomb is making up a quote. Sorry, you're way too early buying an electric vehicle. There's no way Vermont's charging infrastructure will be in place anytime soon. So just some reading material, and not to get too political, the reason, if you do read the article from Kevin McCallum given, is that they were worried if they push too hard in the courts with the other states that they may jeopardize the big transportation bill that comes to the state, I think, in the next year, which is way, way more money than the $17 million that would have come to Vermont. But there was definitely a disagreement between the executive, Governor Scott, and our Attorney General, Charity Clark, on that issue. Henry, we got about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah, and so more activity, and we will do a program on this in the future, is that South Royalton is working on a multi-building, high-efficiency heating and cooling system. And it's likely to use heat pumps tapping into the wastewater stream from the sewers. And that kind of heat pump has the problem that it is expensive to set up, so you'd have to have quite a few households or buildings involved to make sense of it. But once you have it set up, air exchange, heat exchangers, which work well and do provide heat in the winter and all those things, can many houses are now 100% on them with no backup. And those are about three times as efficient as running electric heat. And when you're doing it from ground sources or from tapping into a warmer section to heat or even cool with, as in that wastewater stream, it is another two to three times more efficient than the air source heat pumps. So there's a lot of bang for the buck if we get there. And just one other comment that I put in the show notes is that we're looking at the cancellation of a lot of solar incentives from the federal government, but there is a most recent Volts podcast which points out that you now can build in the United States in a sunny state, so not Vermont for this, but you can now build solar with battery backup to give you 24-hour-a-day electricity supply for something like AI, which is pushing a lot of the demand. And it is cheaper than doing it with a new gas turbine or with other cheap sources like that that are thought of as being what you have to do because solar and battery are too expensive. So, and the price last from 23 to 24 dropped 40% for solar storage, and it's dropping now.
Wow.
As well.
Yeah, if you're living, yeah, like you say, a really sunny state. I was studying Nevada a little bit. That was a music theme on an earlier show today, and I was surprised. I knew it was had desert and everything, but it is one of the most irradiated states. In other words, sunny days there. So that type of setup for somebody living in Arizona or Nevada or Utah would be ideal. Hey, we're wrapping up with Paul Winter. I just want to squeeze in our underwriters here on Green Zine at WFVRLP South Royalton, and they include the Yes We Can Collective, Wit and Grit, the White River Partnership, Solar Fest. They've got a lot of workshops all 3 days, the 8th, 9th, and 10th of August over in Brandon, Vermont. We will be over there. I know Henry's attending. I'll be there the entire time. Radio station is a media sponsor of that event. First Branch Coffee Company, Upper Pass Beer Company, Solaflex Bale, and Daniel Leibowitz. Henry, 10 seconds to go. I'll leave you with the last word.
Yes. Well, we have three possibilities for next week for a subject that we've mentioned all of them.